Sometimes as we see and hear the wickedness of our world, whether it's the school shootings that seem to be all too frequent now, whether it's the drug epidemic, I just heard this week 116 overdose deaths a day in America from drugs, opioids in particular. Of churches and denominations embracing false doctrine and sinful practices, materialism seemingly engulfing the whole world, even China now. We may think that we live in the most evil and wicked of times, that morality and virtue have declined as never before. But the reality is, our corrupt, sinful natures have constantly been evident since the fall. 500 years ago, in a much more pristine time in Europe, John Calvin observed this: this deadly plague reigns everywhere throughout the world. Men are grown mad with an insatiable desire of gain. Things change, and things stay the same. Sinful, wicked hearts. Back around 1500 BC, after Israel had defeated the little city of Jericho guarding the land of Canaan, the book of Joshua tells us of the sin of a man by the name of Achan. A sin that caused the defeat of the army of Israel at the hands of a tiny little town called Ai. Now at Jericho, the spoil of the battle had been dedicated to God. Nothing was to be taken, because everything belonged to God. But during the battle, Achan came upon a beautiful Babylonian garment, 200 pieces of silver and an ingot of gold. And we're told that he coveted them and took them and hid them in his tent. A small thing. It didn't hurt anyone. The people of Jericho, certainly, who were now dead, wouldn't miss them. Who would know? But God knew. And it was disobedience to God. And the result of that sin was the defeat of the army of Israel and the death of 36 of Israel's men. And eventually, the death of Achan and his family as well. As a consequence of the fall, we long for what we do not have. Even what we should not have, we long for. We love the temporal, we love the passing, and we love them more than the eternal and the things of God. Indeed, we love, because of our sinfulness, the unimportant more than we love God. This is not just a problem for unbelievers. This is a problem for Christians. Jesus is addressing these words to his disciples, to citizens of the kingdom, to those that have been born again. And Jesus turns from a discussion of the discipline of fasting, the denying of physical food for spiritual benefits, and he turns to the area of earthly belongings and money, and teaches us to be careful of what we live for, raising the question of, where are your affections? Because that shows, in reality, where your heart is. Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. Perhaps a little more literally, he says, do not treasure earthly treasures. Understanding the attitude of the typical Jew toward wealth might be helpful here, because the Jews thought material wealth equaled the blessing of God. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning with verse 8, we read this. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe all his commandments which I command you today, then the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. The Lord will command the blessing on you in your storehouses and in all to which you set your hand. And he will bless you in the land which the Lord your God has given you. So the common thinking was that wealth equaled spirituality. Wealth was evidence of God's blessing of the righteous. And yet practically and in reality, it simply provided a justification for covetousness, which Jesus condemned in the Jews of his day again and again as misplaced affection. And here in our text, a poor investment as well. The treasures of this world, Jesus is telling us, are temporary. They're passing. They're decaying. And they have no lasting significant value. Because Jesus said, moths, rust, they're going to destroy them. And if not, thieves will steal them. My children were young. They had certain little toys and items that they valued very highly, kind of special to them, and they would keep them in little boxes. We called them their treasures. And woe to the brother or sister who dared to touch those treasures. As adults, we do something similar, don't we? Only the treasures that we treasure, that we value, are bigger, more costly, more important. But like children's treasures, adult treasures can be lost and destroyed in many ways. Jesus says moths. Moths can destroy garments, even expensive garments. Over the years, I've had several wool sweaters, for example, with little holes in them from the moths. In Bible times, garments were often used as a store of value by the wealthy. The one that Achan stole was an expensive Babylonian garment. After Elisha healed Naaman, remember, he was offered two garments woven with gold and silver. Now moths could eat the wool or the other fabric that they might be made of, but not the gold. But in the process, they would destroy the value of the garment. Jesus mentions rust. The word rust means eating. And of course, rust eats away at metal, and that's the connection. But I had a rifle I thought was safely stored in my Michigan basement, only to find that the humidity in the air rusted it, requiring some expensive repairs. But that's not all. If the bugs and the mice, the rust, don't reduce your treasure, Jesus says, well, thieves will break in and steal it. In Christ's day, thieves would literally break in. You see, they didn't have banks like we have, and if you had an accumulation of money and perhaps some set aside for retirement, what did you do to keep it safe? Well, one of the things that they did, because their homes were made of brick and stone primarily, they would put gold coins or silver coins inside of a brick and seal it up and put it into the house, and it would be there and supposedly safe. And thieves, if they suspected there was such value in a house, would go in and literally break the house apart, digging holes in the house, looking for treasure. Things are different today. We have banks, and we have protection from police and so on, but there are still thieves breaking in. Americans spend about $21 billion a year for home security, just home security. And that doesn't count police costs and computer security costs, etc. Walmart, it is said, estimates that they lose $3 billion a year in theft. Just this past week, Discover Card called. They'd found some fraudulent charges on our card, and so they had to stop things and fix things and send us a new card. And that's not the first time. Perhaps some of you have had similar experiences. Thieves, now they're more sophisticated than digging into a house and breaking bricks apart. They're still breaking in, seeking to steal. The point Jesus is making is that the building of earthly treasures and the spending of time and energy and resources in accumulating them is to put your trust in something that will not endure. One way or another, it disappears. And even if you manage to accumulate wealth, you cannot take it with you. Paul put it this way in 1 Timothy 6:7. We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. So instead of putting our hopes in the passing treasures of earth, Jesus says we should concentrate on the kind of investment that will last. We should lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Heavenly treasure. Incorruptible, indestructible, can't be stolen, can't be lost, even at death. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 11, verse 24 says, "By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoying the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. For he looked for the reward to come. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured as seeing him who is invisible." And Moses forsook worldly wealth and power and prestige, earthly treasures, if you will, to obey and pursue a heavenly reward from the living God. A little bit later, Hebrews tells us that this was also Jesus' attitude. Hebrews 12, verse 2, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls." Now remember, Jesus is talking to his disciples. He's talking to citizens of the kingdom. And he's warning us against the pursuit and valuing and desiring of earthly treasure, because it is ultimately a poor investment. Instead, as disciples of Christ, we need to recognize that we're just pilgrims. Everything is God's. And the earthly possessions that we do have are just a stewardship from Him. We are managers, not owners. And the gain of earthly treasure should not be our longing. Now, earthly things are necessary, at least many of them. I saw an article recently about a special candy bar. A candy bar, priced at $325. I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. That's crazy. How could that be? And I read the article. Well, it comes from some very special cocoa trees. There's only a few of them. They have special taste, etc., etc., etc. Now, I don't know if someone gave me that candy bar, I don't know that I could eat it. It's just beyond understanding, isn't it? But there are things in this world that we do need. But ultimately, the things of this world are just a means to an end. And we ought not to be confused and make them an end. The things of this world, the treasures of this world, if you will, are put into our hands in one way or another to bring glory and honor to God. We are His servants. We are stewards of His treasures and not our own. And Jesus' point is, if we're investing our lives in temporal treasures, we are going to lose it. Proverbs 11:4. Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. Or as some wit put it, hearses have no trailers. Jesus put it this way in Luke 12:15, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist of the abundance of the things he possesses. The world might value people by their wealth, by their power, by their possessions, but God does not. Your treasures mean nothing to Him and have no value to you for eternity. Now, we do have financial responsibilities. We are to provide for our families. We are to plan for the future. 1 Timothy 5:8, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. King James says infidel. But Jesus' disciples, though needing money and using money, are not to love money. Our security as disciples of Jesus Christ is in God, not in earthly treasures. And what is important to you, Jesus says, is indicated by your desires, verse 22 and 23. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Jesus goes from your heart to your eye. I guess we could take the larger context. He goes from your stomach and denying the things of your stomach to your heart and to your eye. And he does so because the eye brings the world into your heart. When Achan professed his sin, this is what he said in Joshua 7:21. When I saw, through the eye, when I saw among the spoils a beautiful Babylonian garment, And 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels. I coveted it and took them. Eve had a problem with her eyes as well. Genesis 3:6 tells us, so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. We need to understand that the problem is not just having earthly treasures, treasures that are passing away and temporary. The problem is desiring them, longing for them, living for them. It's fixing our eyes upon them. It's fixing our eyes upon the wrong things and, like Achan, coveting them. Jesus says, in essence, it's the worship of false gods, a deadly desire. And Jesus warns against it in Mark 4:19. He warns the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, the desires for other things entering in and choke the word so that it becomes unfruitful. Satan loves to dangle the world before our eyes. He seeks to make us discontent and unhappy and longing for what we do not have. Coveting even what we should not have. Isn't it interesting that the 10th commandment at length discusses this problem of covetousness? When Jesus was being tempted for 40 days in the wilderness, one of the things we're told that Satan did was to show him all the kingdoms of the world. Say, wouldn't you like these? I.e., wouldn't you like to rule over these as king without the cross? So Paul tells Timothy, 1 Timothy 6:9, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. As a disciple of Jesus Christ, where are your eyes fixed? Are they fixed on the passing pleasures and treasures of this world? Or are they fixed on God? The things of God, that which is eternal and lasting. Paul talks about being transported into heaven, at least in a vision. He says the things there are so glorious, I can't even express them. Jesus says that's where our eyes should be. A city whose builder and foundation is God. Later in Matthew, Jesus talks about the greatest man in history. Who do you think he named? Children, who do you think he named? A man of wealth like Job, patient, righteous. God declared him righteous. A man of great wisdom like King Solomon, who gave us so much of Scripture. A man of great faith like Abraham, who is the father of the faithful, we're told. A great king and poet like King David. And the answer is none of those. Instead, Jesus named a prophet who ruled no one, who lived in the desert. He wore a garment of camel skin, rough, unattractive clothing. We're told that he ate a diet of locusts and honey. Jesus said this, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John. John had his eyes fixed on God, on heaven, on serving the kingdom. And nothing else mattered. Not the praise of King Herod. Not wealth, not comfort, not even his life. Just Christ. And God's perspective, and it's one that is so different than the world's, and I'm afraid so different than even ours as Christians. God's perspective was that John was the greatest of men. Jesus is calling upon his disciples, like John, to fix our eyes upon God, upon his will, seeking his glory rather than the passing treasures of this world. Christian, where is your heart? Where are your eyes fixed? Jesus continues, "You see, no one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." What drives you? What's important to you? Is it the decaying and temporary treasures of the world? Or is it the eternal living God and his reward, his treasures? Jesus says you can't have both. You can't serve two masters. The word mammon sounds pretty much like the Greek word or the Aramaic word. It simply means riches, money. Jesus is saying you can't live for both God and money. You can only serve one. Jesus isn't condemning money. He's not condemning the use of money. What he is condemning is the making of earthly things into sacred treasures. Of investing our lives to acquire that which is temporal and passing and insignificant in light of eternity. Instead of loving and serving the living God who saved us and rightfully rules over us. So Paul says, 1 Timothy 5:8, "If anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Well, we need to provide for our families. We do need to eat and dress and provide housing. But when we cross that line and set our desires upon money and all the things that money buys, then we sin. And we are loving and serving a false God that cannot save. Jesus' point is that you cannot serve, you cannot love two different masters. There will always be one that you love the most. If you try to serve both, you've already given your allegiance to mammon. You cannot serve the Creator and the created at the same time. In one sense, this is not about money at all. Money is just a tool. It's really a question of your heart. It's a question of your affections. Again, Paul in 1 Timothy 6:10, he says it's the love of money. And the word love there that he uses is not agape, it's phileo, it's affection. An affection for money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. For the disciple of Jesus Christ, there is a relationship between your love for God and your money. Abraham's nephew Lot, you will recall, was taken captive by neighboring warlords. Abraham pursued with his servants and overtook them, and God gave him the victory. He defeated those bandits and delivered Lot from danger. And then as he was returning home, Abraham met Melchizedek, who we're told is king of Salem and priest of the living God, and also a type of Christ. They ate together, and Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And then what did Abraham do? Interesting. He gave God, through Melchizedek, 10% of his spoils. Abraham loved God more than his money. A little later, when Jacob fled from home after deceiving Isaac, his father, he stopped in a place called Bethel. And that night, he had a vision of God. And God promised to bless him and to prosper his way. And what did Jacob do? He made a vow. This is his vow. If God will be with me and keep me in the way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. Jacob, too, loved God more than his money. Now we come to the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is instructing us of the nature of true disciples, of the ethic of the true citizen of the kingdom. And what is interesting is, Jesus spends about 20% of his teaching in the Sermon on the Mount on money. Why would he do that? Jesus is not obsessed about money and the gaining of money. He did not even have a place to put his head. He lived, if you will, in near poverty. Jesus is spending time on money because he knows there's a relationship between gold and godliness. There is a relationship between your attitude and heart's attitude toward money and God. You are no stronger spiritually as a disciple of Jesus Christ than your attitude toward money and what place it has in your life. Because, as Jesus puts it, you cannot serve two masters. Jesus, in talking about money, is probing your heart. And who do you truly love? What do you truly love? Where are your affections? Who or what are you living to serve? Are you investing your life in the service of the God of this age? All for the treasure, perhaps, of Chinese trinkets that one day will be trash. Or Jesus is asking, are you investing your life in the kingdom of heaven, in a treasure that will last for eternity? Joshua put it this way: choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Will you and your house serve the Lord or the gods of Canaan? Shall we pray?